Good evening, Zimbabwe. You are listening to Studio 7 from the Voice of America on Wednesday, May 4th, 2016. Thank you for joining us live from Washington. This is Jonga Kandemiri.
And I'm Marvelous Mhlanga Nyahuye.
Here are our top stories this evening.
Zimbabwe introduces bond notes to ease cash shortages.
ZANU-PF once again is trying to introduce Zimbabwean currency through the sector. That's the disaster of the year. The way the economy responds to notes now is the same way it responded to notes 5 or 8 years ago.
The police have blocked a planned march by churches on Friday against the introduction of the controversial national pledge in schools.
The police has just written a letter back to us to say that because there is a court case that is pending in the Constitutional Court, we should wait for its outcome before we do the prayer march.
Lack of accommodation forces some Zimbabweans to live in toilets.
We decided to occupy these toilets because we do not have any decent accommodation.
And Zimbabweans are happy with the smooth operations at the nation's passport offices.
These stories coming up. Stay tuned.
Zimbabwe's central bank says it will soon introduce bond notes to ease serious cash shortages in the country. According to The Source, an independent financial business news entity, the governor of the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe, John Mangujga, who made the announcement today, the bond notes are likely to be introduced within the next 2 months. Zimbabweans are currently being restricted to a daily withdrawal of $50 due to the cash crisis. The country introduced bond coins a year ago, which were rejected by many people claiming that the nation was attempting to reintroduce the defunct Zim dollar. The source further noted that, with effect from tomorrow, 40% of all new U.S. dollar receipts will be converted to the rand. Mangujga said this is designed to restore and promote the wide usage of currencies in the multi-currency basket. The source also reported that the public will only be able to withdraw a maximum of 1,000 euro and 20,000 rands from their accounts on a daily basis. Studio 7 was unable to clarify this issue with the central bank as Mangujga's mobile phone was not reachable. Some critics immediately said indications are that Zimbabwe will start printing money in the form of bond notes, like what it did during former Governor Gideon Gono's term of office, in which the country printed worthless bearer checks running into trillions of dollars. Zimbabwe recorded unprecedented hyperinflationary figures, leading to the scraping of its own currency. For perspective, Studio 7's Gibbs Dube reached the economic commentator Rejoice Ngwenya.
Well, frankly speaking, Dube, that's a disaster of the year because, the way the economy responds to notes now is the same way it responded to notes 5 or 8 years ago. So there's not going to be any difference. The market is quite satisfied with the coins, but the notes are going to face the same inflationary, hypertension as the Gono, dollar bills. There is absolutely no difference. ZANU-PF once again is trying to introduce Zimbabwean currency through the sector.
So what could be the alternative, Mr. Ngwenya, to these bond notes?
Look, the alternative for any country is to have a functional economy. So bringing in notes does not help because it does not answer to the problems of productivity. So the shortages of money are not the shortages of U.S. dollars. It is the deficit in the productive capacity. Malawi has its own currency. Zambia has its own currency. Tanzania has its own currency because they have a sustainable manufacturing and export base. So what John Yangja is supposed to be doing is supposed to be focusing on reigniting productivity, not bringing back bond notes, because as I said, it's going to be exactly the same way as we were treating the agri-bills.
That was Rejoice Ngwenya, an economic commentator speaking with Studio 7 from Harare.
Police in Bulawayo have banned a planned march by churches on Friday against the introduction of the controversial national pledge in schools. Organizers were told to wait for a determination on the matter as it was already before the court. Despite the setback, churches and civil society groups in Bulawayo are pushing back against the pledge with a campaign encouraging parents and guardians to write to school heads, telling them not to force their kids to take the pledge. Studio 7's Ntungamili Nkomo reached one of the clergymen pushing this campaign, Hussein Sibanda.
The police has just written a letter back to us to say that because there is a court case that is pending in the Constitutional Court, we should wait for its outcome before we do the prayer march. And they've written the letter to actually say that a government has directed those who have reservation on the matter to approach courts for determination. But of course, it is our constitutional right to, you know, to do the march and to pray. We're just notifying the police. But however, we thank them because so far they've been very cooperative. We have worked very well with them. So we're going to put this before the churches and discuss the issue on what's the best way to handle that.
Tell us more about your campaign urging parents to write letters of protest to school heads.
We have done a simple letter where the parents can write even on a piece of paper and sign it. And the letter is simply notifying the head of the school not to force, or maybe rather to exempt that child from taking part in the national pledge. And the parent will specify the name of the child, the class in which that child is in, and then ask the school not to involve the child in the national pledge. That is binding to the school head. Because constitutionally, the parent has got the legal authority or custodian of that child and can determine how that child should be groomed in terms of religious convictions and so forth. So we believe that the school will not have the upper authority over the parent to force the child to do something which the parent has refused. We have put it online, we have put it on WhatsApp, and we have sent it all over. We are hoping that parents all over the country will see it so that the parents will make sure that their children are not compelled by force to do the national pledge.
Reverend Hussein Sibanda is one of the church leaders against the national pledge.
About 50 families in Chinoy, Mashonaland West Province have converted toilets into dwellings due to lack of accommodation in the town. Our correspondent Arthur Chigwariwa has more details from the provincial capital.
Residents of Shekelton, 10 kilometers away from Chinoy, said lack of accommodation forced them to live in abandoned toilets despite dangers of contracting contagious diseases. When Studio 7 visited Shekelton, some families were busy cleaning toilets while others were moving their property into the spruced-up oblation facilities. Mrs. Nometa Somondo, a mother of 6 who has failed to get proper accommodation in the town due to lack of money, said she is occupying a small toilet which does not offer enough space for her family.
We decided to occupy these toilets because we do not have any decent accommodation. We only have one room which we are all sharing, all of us, with my husband and kids.
Other toilet occupants who only wanted to be identified as the Mbirimi family said they failed to get residential stamps for years and they had to resort to such type of accommodation as the council did not offer an alternative place. Mrs. Mbirimi explains.
There is no decent accommodation here. It would be proper if we were given stands, but we are not getting anything from the council. We have no place to live, and that is why people are living in these toilets. It would be good for us to get our own stands because we have a bit of money.
Mrs. Tomondo said she doesn't care about the dangers of contracting diseases.
We are not scared of any diseases because we have no place to go. You can even get some disease even if you don't live here.
Shekelton Ward 15 Councillor Innocent Mangwanya said there's nothing wrong in allowing residents to convert toilets into residence as they are no longer in use. But Chinoy Mayor Test Michaels said the local authorities to investigate the issue before issuing a statement. According to council meetings dated 15 January 2016, there are about 12,000 people on the housing waiting list. Reporting for Studio 7 in Chinoy, this is Atach Goriwa.
Zimbabwe's Ministry of Social Welfare has cautioned young women and girls who received employment offers in foreign countries to exercise due diligence before accepting such offers. This follows the tracking saga of Zimbabwean women to Arab states like Kuwait by so-called employment agents in both countries. We give you more details on the issue. Social Welfare Minister Prisca Mufumira says her ministry is currently investigating the issue of human trafficking of Zimbabwean women and girls following the return of 32 of them from Kuwait, where they were abused after being promised good jobs by employment agents. The women are part of the 200 that are in that country where they were seeking greener pastures. Although the ministry has not yet finished compiling the report on the recent returnees, Mufumira urged women and girls to exercise extreme caution when seeking employment abroad.
A word of advice to young ladies looking for work in countries which they are not familiar with, to be very careful, because we've had very serious incidents of young girls who had gone to work in Kuwait and they came back reporting very serious abuse, and we are investigating to find out exactly what was happening to them.
Mufumira said her ministry, in conjunction with other organizations, would continue to work with the repatriated women and girls to ensure that they are reintegrated into their communities in a respectful way.
32 ladies had arrived over the weekend, and we expect many more to come. So the word of advice is for ladies not to venture into countries which they are not familiar with, either the culture, the language, and everything. Just be cautious.
Mufumira's ministry was handed over the 32 women and girls brought by a parliamentary delegation led by the Speaker of the House, Jacob Mudenda, who negotiated the repatriation from Kuwait following a parliamentary visit to that country. Opposition party MDCN parliamentarian Priscilla Misiairambwi Mushonga, who was part of the delegation that helped repatriate the women from Kuwait, castigated government for failing to take up its responsibility of making sure that citizens are safe and in cases that they face difficulties on foreign land are repatriated.
I am so angry with government. I think there are many things that government should have done, and I'm holding fire until I raise those things formally with government. But yeah, I think there are many things that government could have done. One, to make sure that these girls don't go and are not seen in terms of helping those girls when they were there. It is not our business as parliament to be doing repatriation. That to be forced to do that is an indication of the level of incompetence that is in our government. That somebody, an individual, to fundraise and fund this is an indictment on government.
Seven agents who were part of the ring that helped recruit the women and girls were held before a Harare court a few weeks ago, but are out on bail, a situation that is infuriating some women rights groups. However, some rights groups in the country say this is not a time for playing blame games, but instead a time to put heads together and come up with a comprehensive plan of addressing the root causes of human trafficking and providing psychosocial support for those that have been repatriated. African Union Goodwill Ambassador on Early Child Marriages, Nyara Zai Gumbonjanda, also called on African governments to make situations in their countries conducive so that women and girls are not forced by circumstances to take up employment in countries that they are not familiar with and are likely to fall prey to human trafficking rings. One of the young girls who returned with the 32 from Kuwait, Leah Marimira, says the treatment she faced in that country at the hands of her employer was inhumane. But Marimira says that she was not sexually abused and is now exploring ways of restarting her business of buying and selling.
My family, they were so happy. It's not good to be a foreign land. Foreign land is not easy.
Human trafficking is the illegal movement of people, typically for the purposes of forced labor or commercial sexual exploitation. According to the U.S. Department of State Trafficking of Persons report for 2015, 55% of trafficked people worldwide are women and girls, and 26% of trafficked persons are children. Some Zimbabwean women and girls still remain in Kuwait and other countries where they are still victims of human trafficking, but it remains to be seen what efforts government will make to ensure their safety and safe return home.
You're listening to Studio 7 from the Voice of America in Washington.
We are broadcasting on 909 Metum Wave and on the 4930, 5940 and 15460 shortwave frequencies.
On the internet, find us at www.studio7news.com.
You can also text us at 001-202-465-0318.
Coming up,
a history professor urges Zimbabweans to write books about their country.
Stay tuned.
But first, a look at regional and international news.
Ohio Governor John Kasich, one of the last remaining U.S. Republican presidential candidates, is dropping out of the race, clearing the path for real estate mogul Donald Trump to claim the party's 2016 nomination. Kasich was one of 17 original contenders looking to become the party standard bearer in November's national election to pick the successor to President Barack Obama when he leaves office in January. Another candidate, Ted Cruz, suspended his presidential election campaign yesterday after he was defeated by Trump. For perspective, VOA's national correspondent Jim Malone has more.
A year ago, when Trump announced, no one gave him much of a chance of winning the Republican nomination. Well, he's basically the nominee in waiting, and the world is about to get to know him much better than they ever thought they could. Now, Trump goes into the general election a likely long shot against probably Hillary Clinton, the likely Democratic nominee. But here's the thing to know about Donald Trump. He's the most unpredictable candidate in modern times. He's not a professional politician. He's seen as a political outsider. He's self-funding. And he says things that no other candidates are willing to say. All of this makes Trump extremely hard to run against. You'll note in the primaries that all of the candidates who attacked Trump eventually went down to defeat. And that leaves it up to the Democrats, most likely Hillary Clinton, to decide how they will take on Trump in the general election, to what extent they will attack him, and to what extent they will try to frame the race around the personality, the volatile personality of Donald J. Trump. So we'll be looking for that. Not only that, Trump has a long way to go to explain his foreign policy, how he sees the rest of the world. He gave a recent speech in Washington, but it left more questions than answers on the table. So we're going to have to see how the Trump candidacy evolves in the months to come. The lingering question is, even though Trump is by far the odds-on nominee, he's dispatched virtually all his rivals, the question is, will the party really unify behind Donald Trump? And there's some questions about that. A lot of the establishment Republicans still distrust Trump. We've even had a few people talking they might even support Hillary Clinton. I wouldn't look for a lot of that to happen. The fear for Republicans is some of the mainstream Republicans will simply stay home in November. They won't vote. And that's got to be a fear among the Republican organizers for the campaign. They're going to need everyone out to vote in November if they have any chance of defeating the Democrats and Hillary Clinton.
Thanks, Jim Malone.
Zimbabwean-born professor of African history at the University of California, Moze Chikore, who has authored a book, African Music, Power and Being, a Colonization of Zimbabwe, has urged Zimbabweans to write books to preserve their history and culture. Professor Chikore, though, says trying to break an industry dominated by writers from developed nations has challenges, but that must not discourage people from writing books. Chikore is also touring American states with Chimurenga music guru Thomas Mafumo, narrating a chapter in his book while Mafumo plays his music in the background. Professor Chikore tells Studio 7's Blessing Zulu that the idea of writing a book was conceived at the University of Zimbabwe.
By the use that 2001, I did a research project on the economics of music for my honors thesis. And so since then, the idea never left me, really.
The book begins in the 1890s. Why is this significant?
This is some kind of historiographical intervention that I make, because, again, as a student, I was reading all these books. Well, not too many, but enough that have been written prior to mine, which basically starts with the story of Zimbabwean and Southern African music from the 1930s. This is a very exciting point in time in Zimbabwean and Southern African histories, and especially urban African histories. This is when Africans were moving from the mission schools, from the reserves, going to the locations. They are coming as educated Africans to play these very interesting cultural, political roles. So this is at the apex of colonial urbanization. So I wanted to understand how actually these urban cultures that Joyce Jenjemakwenda in her book, for example, Township Music, interpret from an urban perspective. Where did this music come from? What had shaped the influences, the perspectives, the world views of these people actually performing at mime swords, at Stanley Hall, at similar kinds of spaces that have been built in the early township or the location.
Let's talk about music and the Liberation War, since you also include the likes of Dorothy Masuku, Zex Manatsa, Thomas Mapfumo, and others. That is in the 1970s. Would you agree with Alec Pongweni, for example, who wrote a book titled Songs That Won the Liberation War?
Professor Pongweni's interpretation is actually quite fantastic. It's an interpretation that is enduring. What I do, however, again, as a historian, I'm really interested in the past of things and in the past of the present. And so I pose the question when I get to talk about those people. So people locate this music in the 1960s and 1970s, and they make the obvious association with the liberation struggle. But again, things don't just emerge from nowhere. How did this music actually shape up? How did it evolve? How did it emerge? What is its history? What are the deeper genealogies, the deeper roots of this kind of music? My quest for the answer is, again, to go back to the 1890s. Then I see these missionary crusades. Because if you look at the first three chapters of my book, this is basically all an attempt to understand why the people that we talked about earlier in the 1930s are not playing things like mbira or traditional indigenous musical forms, because these things had been demonized by Christian missionaries through their evangelization crusades. Because this music was actually connected with the first Chimurenga, for example. During that war of resistance against occupation, Africans had put in the forefront the word of the spirit mediums. People like Mbuyandehanda, Sekuru Gumboreshumba Kagui, Kwati, such people. And when they were fighting, they were actually singing these songs and appealing to their ancestors to lead them in the struggle. So it is the very same music. It is the very same Chimurenga sensibility that you also see in the 1960s and 70s. So that's how I historicize the music of Thomas Mapfumo, Zex Manatsa, Dorothy Masuku, David Kabachi, all these people.
Now, did you get the opportunity to meet some of the characters in your book?
I met almost all of them, those who are still around. Because what I try to do in this book is to actually present the African voice in as authentic a way as possible.
That was a professor of African history at the University of California, Moze Chikore, speaking with Studio 7's Blessing Zulu from California.
Hi.
Hello, Zimbabwe. This is Chione Sojani, your host for Time to Engage. Today, we have a phenomenal woman, and her name is Audrey Mpunziwana, and she'll be talking to us today about mentorship. Hello, Audrey. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, Chione, and thank you very much for having me on your program.
Tell us why you believe in mentorship.
Well, I think the reason I'm a strong believer in mentorship is because throughout my life, I've been mentored. It's taking all the skills, experience, everything that's been endowed to you, and also sharing that with other people. So very early on in my career, I was very, very fortunate to have people that believed in me and took chances and risks in order to give me an opportunity that I otherwise wouldn't have had. So I believe it's my duty, and it's also a privilege to be able to do the same for other people.
What are the challenges in terms of dealing with mentorship in this regard?
Well, I think mentoring is, it's a long process. Normally the mentor's a very busy person, you know, quite a senior person, or they could be like peers, but I think it requires a lot of time, a lot of energy, and a lot of patience. So time-wise, you need to invest in your mentee, as in make yourself available, and that's available, you know, in terms of time, but in terms of just being there to listen and to give advice. It's a lot of relationship building, and it has to be a two-way thing.
And how did you recognize your mentor and said, you know, I think I could work with this lady or work with this man?
For me, the first mentor I had was way back when I was just starting my career in radio. You know, when you leave university, you're not quite sure what you want to do. So I kind of landed in radio by chance. I was obviously a very junior producer, presenter, and I was actually approached by my mentor to say, you know, I would really like to take you under my wing. So my mentor was a lady called Busi Chindore, and she really sort of showed me the ropes and what do, and she made certain opportunities available to me because I believe she really could see what the potential and the possibilities were. So it's something that, you know, you can, if you see a potential in someone and then they can also feel comfortable enough to learn from you, that's when it becomes really rewarding.
What would you like to tell the youth in Zimbabwe and around in diaspora about the power of mentorship?
It's something that you can't really put a price on. It's very, very valuable for Zimbabwean youth. I would just say, you know, believe in yourself is a very, very good place to start.
Thank you very much. And that was Audrey Mpunziwana on Time to Engage. Your host, Chione Sojani.
Remember to stay tuned for Studio 7 Live Talk at 8:30 p.m. when our hosts Blessing Zulu and Gift Dube will be talking with listeners and experts about press freedom in Zimbabwe.
If you wish to join the show, call us at 001-202-619-2077. The number again, 001-202-619-2077.
Now to recap today's top stories.
Zimbabwe introduces bond notes to ease cash shortages.
Police have blocked a planned march by churches on Friday against the introduction of the controversial national pledge in schools.
Lack of accommodation forces some Zimbabweans to live in toilets.
And Zimbabweans are happy with the smooth operations at the nation's passport offices.
And that's our broadcast this evening.
To join us at 7 every evening for news in three languages, visit us on the internet at www.studio7news.com.
Now stand by for Studio 7 in Ndebele with Ntunga Milinkomo. This is Marvelous Mhlanganya Huye in Washington.
And I'm Jonga Kandemiri, wishing you a pleasant evening and a very good night.